Welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. I apologize to everyone for the long hiatus from this podcast. This fall has been very busy with the launch of the Shotgun Start and then a lot of other stuff, including tons of travel. So it's just been a little bit of a break, but we are going to be coming back strong now with at least hopefully weekly podcasts for the remainder of 2018 and then 2019 also. So expect a lot of new interviews to come up in the near future. Today, I'm really excited for the first part of a two-part podcast with Colin Sheehan. Most of you probably won't recognize his name. He is the Yale golf coach and a former prolific golf writer. He played at Yale also. He wrote for a golf magazine in the late 90s and early 2000s and also published a book about the U.S. amateur in the mid-2000s. So Colin is a great golf course architecture mind, college golf coach, and also a founder of the Outpost Club. So we had a great discussion. It's going to be a two-part podcast, and part one focuses in on the Yale golf team, his coaching there, the Yale golf course, and then amateur golf and the USAM. So I hope you guys enjoy. Part two will be up either later this week or for Monday of next week. Without further ado, here is Colin.
I miss a green, for example, I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
You graduated Yale in 1997. How would you say that college golf has changed since then?
Like all NCAA athletics, probably getting more serious, taking sort of following the lead of revenue generating sports. We're very lucky in the Ivy League. We're not part of the machine that is the NCAA. We're amateur athletics, and we remain so. In some ways, we're closer to D3, where the kids pay to come to school, and yeah, they do get a little bit of support in the process. They don't let us support unqualified candidates, but it does help sort of grease the skid for the applicant. But the kids, at least in terms of golf, the beautiful thing is they take it so seriously, and it's not getting covered on SportsCenter, and there's very little attention. If it wasn't for the occasional parent or girlfriend, there wouldn't be any spectators, and yet the kids play their hearts out. They put it all on the line. Very lucky. It's a 122-year-old program. We had 21 national championships all in the Hickory Shafted era. But it's truly amateur athletics in the best sense of it. And you know, academics are the top priority, but their sport is a close second, and they're dedicated to their craft. We face some sort of headwinds of academic rigor or an academic threshold in the recruiting process, and we are in the Northeast.
You touched on it a little bit, being student athletes, no scholarships. I imagine the class rigors of an Ivy League university have a large effect on practice time. How much less would you say, in terms of hours at the course or hours practicing, do Ivy League players spend than your power conference players?
Well, that's a good question. I wonder how much Illinois practices. There's an NCAA limit to 20 hours on 6 days a week, but I know the kids can voluntarily practice more than that. I mean, we're lucky. We start at the end of August when classes begin, and the kids go pedal to the metal for about 5-6 weeks, and by then they're running on fumes around the time of midterms and when classes are really starting to really ratchet up. So we'll practice during the week, 3 to 6. We're very lucky. The Yale golf course is only 12 minutes from campus. And in that time, you go from sort of a downtown area of New Haven out into the sort of forest where you don't see a single house from anywhere on the course. It really is a on its own, just leaving campus at 2:45, getting to the course on some beautiful day in September to hit balls for half an hour and then play like a twilight nine with your teammates or some of your best friends. Like, it's a pretty good 3 hours on just some weekday afternoon. They come back to campus around 6:15 and go to the dining halls, feeling refreshed, feeling wonderful.
Yeah, seriously.
But I don't have that conflict of interest about the sort of performance of the team, about having that sort of be, it's never a job for the kids. You know, they don't need to be motivated. I don't begrudge any kid who goes to a major conference and maybe even accepts a little scholarship money. I'm always impressed with the kids that do that. They have a sort of vision but you wind up working for the program. You know, they sort of own you. And a lot of coaches, like, they want their kids eligible, but they need them maximizing their practice. And you know, the kids I find it hard for them to have a quality undergraduate experience trying to balance a serious, serious athletic commitment in addition to being a student, in addition to having sort of taking advantage of it was 4 years, should be four wonderful years of your life.
Yeah, yeah. So you've won Coach of the Year a couple times in the Northeast. And you guys have won a bunch of Ivy League championships since you've been there, a bunch of McDonald's Cups, a lot of the tournaments that you play regularly, you guys have won. How would you say that your approach to coaching these kids differs from either, you know, the coach you had at Yale and also other coaches you see around?
Well, I had a legend when I was at Yale, Dave Patterson. He was there 33 years, born in Paisley, Scottish emigre. He was there from 1975 to 2008. He was wonderful. I don't want to compare. I definitely do not want to compare anything I did to him. He's amazing. Or any of the other coaches in the Ivy League. I just, my own approach, I try to be relaxed. I sort of have a degree. I have a serious degree of sympathy for the kids and as they navigate being an undergraduate, being in college, being 18 to 22, trying to play golf. I do my best in the recruiting process. Try to get some really good players. The team success helps that. And you know, I try to have them just be in just a sort of positive mindset. Try to have as little stress and drama on the team side of things. We never focus on winning. We go to tournaments with a team that's always pretty good, but we just focus on being the smartest team out there. The fewest unforced errors, like hedging and playing the odds, knowing when to attack and when to be smart, when to lay back, and things you might do on your own when you're playing tournaments in the summer aren't really sort of maybe always appropriate for a situation when you're playing on behalf of others. We kind of look down on stupid choices.
Yeah, I never really thought about that, but
do it in the summer.
The playing team golf with the five, so in college golf, five scorers, you got five players and four scorers count, like a quadruple bogey from one of your players, like, is devastating in team golf.
Yeah, like they're going to have bad days. They're going to miss shots, but like you can't ever let your score be any higher than it should have been. And I've got certain players who love to attack and take risks. I got to give a shout out to Johnny Lai, class of 17. I mean, the guy just, he was like Maverick out there. It was dangerous. But I've had a few others. Henry deserves a shout out sometimes, just hitting driver, being aggressive, and I'm not going to stop that. I sometimes enjoy watching that. But you're right. You can't. There's just an entirely different element playing on behalf of others. That's the most beautiful thing about it. Like you sacrifice on behalf of your teammates to sort of be prepared for that tournament. You get work done earlier in the week. You don't necessarily go out a certain night. You spend an extra half hour being, addressing sort of aspects of your game that need it. And then for to have five guys go out over a 54-hole tournament to sort of compete under pressure down the stretch, to have those scores sort of add up to a team win after the fact is just, is fabulous. And for a player to be the one that sort of drags the team across the finish line is just, there's nothing more gratifying than that.
Johnny Lai, all-time golf name. So you've mentioned the Yale course a couple times. So it's the top-rated collegiate golf course in the country. Do you think it has like an impact on recruiting? Does it help you get kids because you play a better golf course than most schools?
I think it has to. I'm very so all conversations about the Yale golf course, must include the sort of disclaimer that I'm biased, that I think it's fabulous, and I actually def I have to s defend it a lot of times to the other coaches, particularly, Michael Hughes up there at Brown and Will Green down at Princeton. There's a lot of Yale course haters. There's a lot of blind shot haters. McDonald, there's people that don't see the light, but the facility is incredible. Like I said, 12 minutes from campus. It feels like you're in a nature preserve. You could be in Western Massachusetts. It's like you're up in the Berkshires when you're playing it. It's like, yeah, it gives you that sort of just feeling of being away. It really does.
Having been there recently, I can attest to this. I was in New Haven. I was staying down there, and I was looking around when I got in. I'm like, God, it's so flat. I don't know what everybody's talking about with this, wilderness that is Yale. And all of a sudden, the next morning, I'm driving up, and it just like transforms about 5 minutes outside of the course, and you're just like, oh, these are the hills and everything. And then you're there. It's just so secluded and. It's an incredible golf course. I found myself midway through my first round telling the guy I was playing with, fellow podcast guest, Riley Johns, I was saying, God, I need to move to New Haven. I want to play this place every day. And
Let's go. Nice.
yeah, so
Smart guy. You're a smart guy.
So, in terms of, everybody always says, the Yale course. What it could be versus, what it is. And what it is now is a great golf course, but what do you think the ceiling on the Yale course, if it ever, reached its full potential and got back to its, original self, so say, with great conditioning?
Right. So, I'm very blessed. I get to play some good golf around, here and there. And I don't think there's a course in America that when I come home from playing it, that I don't think Yale stands shoulder to shoulder with. So it's in the peer group of the first order, whatever that is, first 25 courses. I'm not going to suggest it's top 10, but like if even at some point it whatever Chicago Golf is rated, Yale better be ranked higher. Whatever it should it's in the 20s. It's in the low 20s, it's in the high teens. That's a restored Yale. I think the day it opened, it was in the top 10 in America, and now it's 199. That's an interesting story. But it's you can tell that its ceiling is, at some point, these courses in that conversation are just so good. It's just, you know, you're splitting hairs. Mm-hmm. You're splitting hairs among the sort of great 18-hole courses in America, and Yale's in that conversation.
Having been around it so long and so many times, what's the aspect of Yale that and the course that you love the most?
There's no question it's challenging, but it's wide. It's come back to the field in terms of difficulty in the modern age with equipment. I think that the idea of the golf course, it has a deceptively playable, fair, sort of straightforward strategy of sorts. Like, it's not a complicated course to solve, but it's challenging. And I think, like, in that era of McDonald's golf, like, every client had a different request, and Yale came along, brought McDonald out of retirement essentially to design his last course. And on the committee that Yale put together included an undergraduate who was Jess Sweetser, who had just won the U.S. Amateur that fall at the country club, beating Bobby Jones and among others. And I think that was the course that McDonald and Rayner built that was intended for the highest caliber of golfer in the country. It was the closest thing to someone trying to build a U.S. Open venue from that era. I mean, that's really what it was. It had to be essentially a standard scratch score of like 78 when it opened, in the Hickory era with wound balls and wearing tweed jackets. Even the drive on one alone. I mean, it was not a course for everybody, even though there were three sets of tees and they did promote three courses. There were just certain bunkers that I can't imagine your average person could have recovered from.
I think it's like an endemic, like a problem with American golf, with like where a bunker people feel like they have to be able to easily recover from nowadays. I remember during the U.S. Open, people were appalled when guys were missing in a bunker at Shinnecock and couldn't keep the ball on a green. And it's like, if that was a water hazard, you know, nobody would ever complain about it. You know, and the guy would be dropping and hitting his third shot or his fourth shot instead of having a chance to make a bunker shot and, you know, make a birdie. It's like, it's crazy to me because like a really deep bunker at Yale, say like the second, you know, if you hit it in there, it's essentially like going into the water.
Right. And you can play that shot. You know, it's not an the way the sort of I'm fascinated that those bunkers predate the sort of bounce, the Sarrazin wedge. Mm-hmm. You would have had to just open up a sort of thin-soled niblick in the old days and play a really sort of clever picked bunker shot out of the sand. And it must have been so hard.
When you guys have the McDonald Cup and all, you know, you get this year you had Illinois there, you know, a couple years ago you had Illinois there with, you know, when they have now four or five guys from that team that are on, you know, either the web.com PGA Tour or European Tour. What kind of shots are they hitting into the greens now versus, you know, this golf course that when it opened was like a par 78?
Yeah, it's unfair, the loft of the iron they're hitting into the greens. Like 17 for any good college kid, the longer hitters on my team, it's drive and pitching wedge. The principal's nose is an afterthought. There's a number of bunkers on the course that my players are never going to be in. They're never in the right trap on seven. They're no longer in the bunkers on eight. You know, it's just that those shots, those targets used to ask you to sort of approach them with the loft of a four or a five or a present day six iron. And it's just, it fundamentally alters the sort of the difficulty when it's a nine iron or 8-iron or sand wedge. And that's unfortunate. You know, I think the hole that plays the most differently today from in the 90s is 8. I tell this to people, is 8's become a birdie hole for the good college golfer. They rip driver up on the ridge. They've got an attacking wedge. They see the pin. They see the green. They've got the bank on the right to help. And they're generally disappointed if they're not 10 feet with like a good look at birdie. In the old days, hit a spinny driver with like the original great big Bertha and have 167 in a crosswind in early April with the approach was blind, hitting like a 6-iron and praying not to miss an either bunker. I mean, that was how you played the 8th hole at Yale. You tried not to make a 9, and now it's like a birdie hole. I don't, you know, unfortunately, that's the reality of where we've let the ball and the game go. I'm so disappointed that a game of tradition let itself get sort of run roughshod over by the equipment, by a compliant governing body and technology companies run amok.
Yeah. It's crazy that businesses that profit off the game or have more power than the governing body in a sense.
It's a shame that even though for as much as baseball changes, Wrigley Field and Fenway Park and are the identical dimensions, and they're still using sort of, ash bats and the ball might be changing a little, but essentially it's the same game. Like, I can't believe we weren't able to stop it at some point. And so I don't think a course has been more adversely affected, than Yale.
Yeah.
It's just the NCAA said they'd love to bring a national championship to Yale. We've offered. It would be a wonderful place in late May, early June. We'd be able to have these amazing events for the field on campus. And yet they've told us we need to add 400 yards to our golf course.
That's crazy. Minimum. I mean,
minimum.
I played there a couple days and it was funny. I was playing with you. I ripped a tee shot on one with a regular driver, regular ball, had a wedge in. And then I pulled out the hickory shafted driver with a Bellotta ball. And I barely carried the water by like 3 yards. I mean, I carried the water hazard by 3 yards. I would have had like 220 blind shot into the first green. And instead I had 130 yards with it was a little pitching wedge into the green. And I mean, it's madness to me. Yeah.
There's in the original description of how the first hole was played, they reference if you didn't hit your drive far enough, you'd have a blind shot. They're implying that they projected that people would be on the upslope of the fairway and have a blind shot from 210 into the green. Think about that hole right out of the blocks. That's already a 4.5. That's already a par 5 out of the blocks in 1926.
Yeah.
On one at Yale alone. And now the guys fly driver and they get a sort of a forward and to the right sort of kick to the middle of the fairway and down below. And it's a 9-iron or wedge or whatever.
If you could make one change to college golf, what would it be?
Well, everyone would wave. If you could wave the magic wand, you'd have golfers would play in 4 hours and a threesome would be done in 4 hours and 15 minutes. I understand why pace of play is an issue. You're trying, like we mentioned earlier, you can't shoot a stroke higher. You don't want to shoot a single stroke worse than you could have had. You have to take your time on short putts. That really is it. It's the putting that sort of is the speed bump. But if I could change, I wish that clubs would also make themselves more available. It's a shame the majority of the college golf schedule is Monday, Tuesday events with a Sunday afternoon practice round. It's understandable why. It's when the facilities are made available. But that's a lot of class being missed. I know maybe even the sort of major programs, that has to add up. Trying to race home from a tournament, flying on a Tuesday night, nothing can go wrong. in that process, trying to, you know, or else the kids might miss another day of school. I would love to see a culture of architecturally significant courses, private clubs, voluntarily contributing their facility to a venue, and maybe even doing it sort of on a Friday, Saturday, Sunday event with the Friday practice round. And so maybe that's wishful thinking, but that's one thing I would change.
I agree with that. We have in Chicago, the CDGA runs our tournaments, and like in recent years, I remember when I was growing up, they played a lot of really great golf courses, but these recent years, you can just tell that they aren't getting the access to the great clubs that they used to. And I'm 32. It doesn't matter if I play a state amateur at Olympia Fields versus, you know, a okay golf course. Like, that doesn't matter. But I think really when I think about it holistically, what it matters for is the 15-year-old kid that qualifies for the state am, you know, and right. It's his first real championship golf experience. And it's like, if that kid's playing at Olympia Fields or, you know, Chicago Golf or Shore Acres or in those championship conditions, as opposed to playing, you know, a course that never was a championship golf course, when he qualifies for his first USGA event, he's going to be so much more ready for it. And that's where it matters. And it's the same thing with the college program. Like, playing great golf courses helps your kids, I imagine, when they are trying to get to the next level or when they're playing those USAM events, and all of a sudden you step up into a USGA event. It's a whole different beast than playing, you know, your local, you know, county open at Joe Blow Public Golf Course. It's different.
And they get excited about it. And imagine that 15-year-old kid, and he's like, he's got his eyes on qualifying for that event, and he's going to treat it. It's going to be indelible in his memory of those early, you know, when kids play that the first time they ever play a course that had a major or anything in that type of echelon, like, that's such a major milestone for kids. And if, you know, and that's turning them on to sort of architecture and seeing just sort of right, measuring themselves against, you know, adults. And yeah, absolutely. You know, Rand Morissette recently had some list about the custodians of the game. And I understand his list sort of focused on architecture. But I remember very clearly thinking immediately, like, it should be the custodians of the game are that term is for the clubs that answer the question, like, what did you do for junior golf this season? Did you make yourself available for an event or a qualifier or a women's, a girls junior, an amateur event? Like, who do you let play your course? How often do the caddies get out? Is it limited to Mondays? Do the sort of female members have equal sort of representation at the club? Like, what did your course do to grow the game? And, you know, we're very lucky here at Yale that, you know, they've got clinics and they're constantly introducing grad students to the game and undergrads and the New Haven sort of first tee projects. Like, that's a custodian of the game. It hosts the junior PGA 2-day 36 hole, you know, section event. The winner of that goes on to the junior PGA. Like, we need courses to have to in clubs to feel that obligation that it's, you know, and they do, and a lot do, but, you know, a lot don't. You know, nothing annoys me more than a club, you know, sort of this concept that no one plays there, there's no one ever on it. You know, it's like, what good is that? Of course that's their prerogative, but what are they doing to serve the game? And that's, to me, what I think a lot of courses, and I have a lot of respect for the courses that go out of their way to do that. Mm-hmm. I really do. And that make themselves available for those section events and host charity events or whatever it is, like, you know, have where the pro has a thriving junior participation where they've, you know, really dedicated themselves towards having the sort of the juniors at the club sort of engaged and playing and competing in interclubs and things like that.
Yeah. What amazes me too is like you know, we had this one event, and it's like we had two guys reach the final of this, like our state match play tournament. It's like we had two guys that reached the final that are two guys that play in Crump every year, and they're two of the best mid-ams in the country. It's like, is that a big hassle for your club to like have like two of the 25 best mid-ams playing a 36-hole final on a Thursday? Like, wouldn't you want that if your club? Like, wouldn't you want to go watch that?
Right.
It's kind of nutty to me. It's like, you don't want to have like the best players in the state. Like, I get that it's a pain in the ass and not being able to use your club is one thing, but like, you know, it should be looked at as an honor.
A lot of these things.
And that's the way it was, you know, when these courses were built, it was an honor. I mean, that's what this was all centered around. Like, you look at the Philly School of Architecture, those guys did that so they stopped getting their ass kicked by New York and Boston in the Leslie Cup. You know, that's why they started building Marion and Pine Valley and all those other great Philadelphia golf clubs. Is like, they did that so that their amateur golfers could contend.
That's interesting, yeah.
So, you wrote a book after you graduated college about the history of the U.S. Amateur Golf Championship. Outside of, you know, C.B. McDonald's exemplary start to the USAM, who did you find to be the most interesting or the most underappreciated amateur winner that kind of goes overlooked in history?
Well, I just quick correction. I was hired when I was 28. I wrote it mostly when I was 29. So it was in 04, 05. And by the way, I joke that I'll never know the experience of childbirth. However, book took 9 months, it weighed 7 pounds, and it only got completed with an incredibly painful final push that would have been a whole lot better on drugs. It was also simultaneously the worst business decision I ever made and the most gratifying thing I've ever done. Mike Beckridge, the publisher, he offered me $9,000 to do it. And I thought he needed to throw in a complete set of the classics of golf. And when he said yes, I thought that I somehow pulled a fast one on him. Like I was getting a deal, but it was a labor of love. I wrote it from West 72nd Street. I interviewed 47 past champions. I didn't have a car at the time. I'd get up at 6:30 in the morning and I would take the red line from West 72nd Street to Grand Central or no, to Penn Station. And then I would take the sort of New Jersey railroad out to Far Hills. And then I would hitchhike from the Far Hills train station to the USGA library to get there at 9 o'clock. And I spent a few weeks just pouring through the archives and photocopying everything I could. And, you know, and they would make me have to take 12 to one off when the sort of archives were closed. And I guess I'd go outside and have a sandwich and read what I had already sort of worked on, but it was a really great experience. Let's see. It was beautiful to track the history of the game. Of course, there was for the first 25, 30 years, the U.S. Amateur was sort of the more prestigious tournament. The amateur golfers through the 20s were every bit that equal of the professionals, slightly better, obviously, with Bobby Jones. But there was a slew of great players. It was fascinating to watch how it evolved, how it grew. How it moved back and forth in those days when it was basically, there was a stretch when it was Garden City and Chicago Golf. And there was a genuine rivalry between the East and the West and real partisan nature of it with, with the players. I found the, you know, and then I'd say you're probably too young to remember them. Maybe two of the most compelling stories in the U.S. Amateur was Mitch Voges, who was 41 when he won in 1991 at the Honors Course. He was there with his family and his kids. As soon as he was knocked out of the tournament, they were going to go on a family vacation and go see the Black Bears. And the guy had been a great player. Had briefly was at BYU. He was playing basically club events in Southern California. And it was a totally amazing story. And how he made it to the tournament through match play, blisters the size of half dollars on his feet. And he beat Manny Zerman in the finals, you know, one of those sort of all-American college golfers. Really remarkable. And how he went on to play in the Walker Cup that year at Portmarnock. And 2 years earlier was an equally fascinating story of Chris Patton, who was 300 pounds, an All-American at Clemson. And he won the U.S. Amateur at Marion. And I think he grew up on a soybean farm in rural South Carolina, real sort of great athlete, was a sort of slugger in Little League and played once before Christmas 1 year when he was 12. His parents got him a set of clubs and he went out and shot a 127, and then by the following summer he was like a scratch golfer.
That's nuts.
And then the last practice round at home before he left for Marion, he made like 10 birdies in a row on his way to go to Marion. And what was interesting is he was always presented as an oddity because he was overweight. He was kind of it was kind of really easy to portray him as like a Southern redneck. And he was, of all the people I interviewed, I would always transcribe. And when I was transcribing them, you know, some of you had to edit more than others. And Chris Patton actually like spoke in these perfect paragraphs, and he gave the best answers. And I felt like either one of those guys could have the material for a movie or a story or a book on their wins, fleshing those out, like really great struggle. And I think one of my favorite takeaways from the book was that inevitably, in order to win the U.S. Amateur, especially in the current format, especially, every single player has an inevitable moment where they're on the ropes, where they, in some cases, it's surviving a playoff to get through with the sectional qualifying, or to be in the sort of the match, the sort of group sudden death playoff, to be the last, those on the number trying to get into match play, or being, you know, two down with three to go in the second round, or one down with one to go. And I love those moments where essentially they were on the verge of elimination long before the finals. Cause you cannot win the Amateur without multiple scares. You know, look at Tiger Woods. He went to the finals of every final hole of every match he was in. So anyway, I always enjoyed those moments where someone felt like their luck had run out and somehow they sort of, you know, because of the vicissitudes of the game, they were able to chip in from the edge of the green and their opponent like three putts from 12 feet, like things like that. Mm-hmm. I always loved that.
That's the thing with the USAM. It's funny because like the PGA Tour has their match play tournament, and they've over the years, it's become less and less of a match play tournament. You know, now it's got round robin pool play to figure out the 16. And it's like, they just can't seem to embrace the underdog story, or like the interesting story of, you know, everybody always goes back to when, was it Kevin Sutherland? They had like Kevin Sutherland was in the finals. I forgot who he was playing, but it was like the 63rd seed versus the 61st seed. Like, but in the NCAA men's basketball tournament, I mean, that would be revered if you know, if a 12 seed faced off against an 11 seed, people would be going nuts in the final four. And it's so interesting because the USAM, nobody knows the players yet. So there isn't this problem that like, oh no, like if Dustin Johnson gets knocked out, it's bad for TV.
Right. So, by the way, in, Jay Siegel, who is like a reinstated amateur, you know,
was a dominant amateur in the 70s and 80s. He wins twice in like 82, 83. And he's trying to be the first player ever to win the US Amateur three times. Before Tiger did it, it was a thing. Like Jones never did it. No one had come around to it. You know, Harvey Ward won twice and then was ineligible. It's unusual that no one had ever won it three times in a row. And he makes match play in Oklahoma, I think at Oak Tree, and he loses to Rocco Mediate, giant killer, this 19-year-old kid from like Western PA no one had ever heard of. And he sort of, it was like one of the great upsets in amateur golf. And it was interesting that he nearly did it to Tiger at Torrey Pines, you know, like kind of,
You know,
Rocco, think about that. 19-year-old kid who didn't know any better. But then again, you're right. That's the beauty of 18 holes. Bobby Jones said it. There's nothing more perilous for the sort of favorite than an 18-hole match. Anything can happen. A golfer who, but all of them had compelling stories, but Vinny Giles, sort of Marvin Vinny Giles, kind of lost on the sort of golf history scene at the moment. He famously had a long career as an agent. He could have played pro and he opted, even in the mid 60s, there was still sort of his reluctance to turn pro was like, you don't make any money. You stay at the Holiday Inn, you know, with the sort of coarse towels and the little bar of soap. Like he went to law school instead. He followed an amateur career. Even as late as the late 60s, he didn't see the sort of upside of PGA Tour living back then. It's kind of interesting.
Do you think we'll ever see an amateur, somebody stay amateur and not turn pro? And like, will we ever see another Bobby Jones, Harvey Ward type player?
You know, I thought maybe Maverick McNealy had that chance, you know, sort of. I understand. I don't sort of second guess his decision, but he had the potential to do just that. I think it's out there. You know, there used to be tons of those guys.
Yeah.
You know, Robert Sweeney, who lost to Palmer at Country Club of Detroit in 1954. He was this fascinating individual. He like gave strokes to Hogan at Seminole. He was like the stylish Wall Street banker, like lived on Park Avenue, played at Sands Point and Seminole, was like a +2, won the British Amateur, went to Oxford, flew for England. He and his brother helped fund like a squadron for England when it was still the Battle of Britain before like United States even got involved in World War II. It's like there's like types of characters out there used to be more common. Willie Ternissa and his family. You're right. I would love to. Nothing would make me happier than seeing somebody come along, you know, like a better Nathan Smith to like win the amateur someone to sweep the U.S. and British amateurs in the same year. And I would love to see an amateur. I would like to see another amateur win on the PGA Tour. That would be good.
I think that's going to happen with one of these kids one of these days.
Right.
That'll happen. I mean,
yeah.
Shane Lowry won the Irish Open as an amateur too.
Nice.
Years ago. But the I mean, like it was amazing this year. Like Stuart Hagestad got to the round of eight in the USAM and everybody was like going nuts. It was like,
right.
It's like Stuart Hagestad is a great mid-am player, but you know, I remember he texted me once and he said, you know, like if Maverick stays am, I'm so screwed. Like, you know, he's going to win every single mid-am by the time when he's 25, he's going to win every year for decades. What do you think about the reinstated am?
I think that they play like super ams for the rest of their life. I think they're already very good.
Yeah.
And I think that there's some aspect of those years when you were playing 52 weeks of the year as a pro that stay with you. They have to be allowed to come back. I have no problem with the process. I don't hate the players. I don't hate the game. It is what it is. Maybe mid-am should be 30. maybe reinstated ams can't compete in the USAM for a certain number of years. Maybe it's 5. They can be amateurs, but they maybe, I don't know. I don't have a strong hot take on reinstated ams, but I do like seeing though the story of the guy, I'm forgetting his name, the guy who won the mid-am last year, and he, the firefighter from Brockton, Massachusetts.
Perzali, Matt Perzali.
I love that. I'm glad that there's sort of a little bit, the amateur scene is wider than it used to just be, a sort of Pine Valley Seminole crowd, which was great. But like, you know, I'm glad to see that sort of elite kind of, those sort of career amateurs that really love to compete kind of. I like seeing sort of more and more of them coming out from sort of all over the place.
Yeah, yeah. We gotta get some of them in the USAM. It can't be just the mid-am.
You've been listening to the Fried Egg Podcast. We do the digging for you.